Today on Wings.
The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence found that the average sentence for a woman who killed an intimate partner was 15 to 20 years, but for a man it was 2 to 6 years.
We never hear about male entitlement. We never see the context of male violence.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today's Wings program comes from two episodes of Megan Murphy's podcast series, Feminist Current.
Karen and Gala Smith began counting Britain's murdered women, putting their names on her own blog, back in 2012. There were 126 women killed through male violence that year, 143 in 2013, and 150 in 2014. She launched the Femicide Census, which profiles women killed by men. I spoke with her over the phone about these projects from her home in London.
Tell me about this database that you've created.
There are two different databases. The first one is the one that I've been doing for a while, Counting Dead Women, which is one I've been just keeping on my own, collating reports from the media about women killed by men in the UK. And then the other one is the Femicide Census, which is a partnership between myself, Women's Aid, the National Domestic Violence Charity in England, international law firm Freshfields, and international finance and consultancy firm Deloitte. Freshfields got in touch with me a couple of years ago because they were wanting to do some work on women killed in domestic violence. And they were trying to find information about the number of women killed and the cases of women killed. And they were able to find no central data from the government. All they could find was my blog. They got in touch to get information about cases, but through our conversations, we realised that this is something that's lacking an official record of women killed by men. So we started working together, and they sent out freedom of information requests to all the police authorities and health authorities in the UK, and Deloitte then built a purpose-built database for us. So now we have information on all women, or we believe all women killed by men in the UK between 2009 and 2013.
And why is this information missing? You know, why did you need to go out and find it? Why isn't there already something like this? You know, you would think that this would be on record with the police department.
I think it's on record with the Home Office, but it's not made public. And I just think there hasn't been an identified need or interest. The statistic in the UK that two women on average are killed every week by a partner or former partner is really quite well known. But I think it's too easy to say that and to be disconnected to the reality of what that means. And I wanted to humanise that stat, to womanise it, and also create awareness so that we get an accurate picture of what's actually going on. And then thirdly, to raise awareness of it not just being about women killed by partners or former partners, that women are killed by men outside of those relationships as well.
It seems like one of the aims of this project is to debunk myths about male violence against women and girls. I wonder if you can talk about some of those myths.
Yeah, I think one of the main ones is that we're talking about domestic violence. Domestic violence counts for usually between 50% and two-thirds of incidents of men killing women every year. And I think that when we talk about men killing women, that's the first thing that most people think about. It's not so much a myth, but a misunderstanding that's quite common. And also there are stereotypes based on race, on culture, on poverty. And I want to challenge that myth that this is about culture, that's something out there, that's something different. And also that this is a problem in working class people, that male violence against women cuts across all those barriers.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about the idea that some people might say that it's just a cultural problem. What are some examples of that?
I think the most interesting example is that I can stand in front of a crowded audience and say male violence against women is a cultural problem, and there's a great intake of breath as if I've said something really wrong, and then I go on to say it's absolutely integral and systemic in mainstream UK culture. And it's as if people are surprised that I dare. I think there's this notion that culture is something that's out there that belongs to other people, that it doesn't belong to all of us. And so people are surprised when we talk about culture in a way that means us, all of us, regardless of our differences. So I think that's one of the most fundamental misunderstandings of what culture is that needs unpicking. And I think there's also ideas that traditional practices or harmful practices are, again, something that happen elsewhere in other cultures. And people don't understand that we've got, I suppose, a cultural lens, so that what's normal and everyday for us, we don't accept that actually that's cultural conditioning. And so plastic surgery, harmful beauty practices, pornography, these are the use of prostitution. These are all cultural examples of male violence against women that are mainstream, and people don't recognize them as such. There's that the common understanding that what's mainstream is what's normal. It isn't culture, and I want people to understand that actually we are all cultural products. That's probably a bit of a general sociologist beef rather than a male violence against women issue as well.
Yeah. Obviously, every incident of male violence against women is horrible. But I wonder if in doing this work and working on this project, were there any particularly pertinent stories or incidences that you came across, stories that stood out for whatever reason?
It's the pictures sometimes that some touch me in a particular way. Sometimes we see pictures of women looking radiant and happy, and then you read a news report, a court report on the reality of their lives, and the disconnect is really something. Or the other example is when I see a photo of a woman, and the photo that the media have got a hold of, she looks really sad. She looks like she might as well have difficult life tattooed across her forehead. And I know photos are just a snapshot in time, but sometimes they're the things that they're what I really connect to. When I read the detail of a beating, a death, a murder, I can't say that there's any one or any that stand out more, because really they're never kind, gentle deaths. They're all brutal and horrific in their own way. I suppose some things that do stand out are the rubbish, pathetic explanations that the media sometimes try to peddle. So whether they're trying to blame a woman's infidelity or benefits culture or people believing in evil spirits. One example in one newspaper was that the man was afraid of a Japanese knotweed, that's a sort of garden weed, invasion in his garden. So you read these stupid explanations away for male violence, but we never hear about male entitlement. We never see the context of male violence. We're lucky if they even say domestic violence, male entitlement to women's bodies. The actual issues behind male violence are never what's presented as the explanation. And I think it's that strikes me, that time and time again, I see headlines using any other explanation, but male violence against women is cultural and endemic.
What's changed over the years in terms of legislation? I know that laws have changed thanks to feminist activism, to the feminist movement, to the work of feminists. What's changed and what still needs to change in the UK in terms of the law around violence against women and domestic violence?
The law's changing all the time, but I think the interesting thing to me, and I've been working in domestic and sexual violence services for nearly 25 years now, is watching how male violence against women has become a mainstream issue. So it's not only, we're not only seeing legal changes, we're seeing policy changes at a more localised level. But what's also happened is that the feminist approach to male violence is being weakened as the themes have become more mainstream. Compared to 20 years ago, we might see more funding and we might see more regularised funding, although there have been cuts over the last 5 years. But what we also see now is less autonomy for women's services. As government and local government has put more funding in, they've wanted more control about the way that services have delivered, and they may push gender-neutral services. We're driven towards what they define as acceptable targets rather than what our experience and what women tell us they need. So in some ways, the environment for service provision has become less authentic and less needs-driven rather than commissioner-driven. I think as well that as funding has become more mainstreamed and there's a push to what might be described as professionalisation of services, that we see being a survivor of male violence become pathologised, that there's more of a gap between us as service providers and them as service users, whereas I think those of us who have been in the movement for many years were survivors or were deeply connected to survivors and activists, and didn't have that sort of us and them approach. We were all women, and we were all women together resisting and fighting against male violence in whatever ways we could.
What impact do you think this project will have? You know, what would you like to achieve? What do you hope can be changed through these databases?
I want us to have more of an understanding of what's going on. I want them to be a research tool, whether that's for students and academics or policymakers, service providers, funders. I want them to be a really a good challenge of so-called gender neutrality. So for example, if we look at fatal violence in the context of relationships, one of the challenges I get all the time is it happens to men too, and that actually we should look at everybody killed in domestic violence rather than women killed by men. But I think the connections between women killed by men in any relationship and those killed by partners or former partners are stronger than those between men and women who kill former partners. So, for example, we know that far fewer than men than women are killed in the context of intimate partner relationships. In the last 3 years in the UK, 57 men were killed and 249 women were killed. But within that, there are important differences. Men are much more likely than women to be killed by a spouse of a partner or a love rival. So 14 of 57 men were killed in that way, none of 249 women. Men are much more likely than women to have been killed by someone of the same sex. So 21 of 57 men were killed by a man. One out of 249 women were killed by women. And also, if we look at the previous history of the relationship, men tend to kill somebody after they've been abusing them for years. Women, if they kill a man, it's usually when they've been a victim of abuse for years. Mm-hmm. So I just want to get this information out there and understood, and this to be what's talked about rather than the myths. And I want us to see male violence against women as systemic and entrenched rather than a series of isolated incidents. And I want us to understand that if we are going to change things, we've got to go really far beyond the criminal justice system and look at much more basic assumptions about what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman and what a relationship is. You know, I think gender is an absolutely poison issue. Masculinity and femininity are a big part of the problem, and I want to break that down. Or not necessarily break that down, but get more people thinking about what we accept as inevitable and natural and what we could change if there was will to change.
You just heard an interview with Karen and Gala Smith, chief executive of NIA, a London-based charity providing services for women and children who have experienced sexual and domestic violence. Karen has been recording and commemorating UK women killed by men since January 2012 in a campaign called Counting Dead Women. I'm Megan Murphy.
Do you know when you're eligible for parole?
2028.
Okay, and how old will you be then?
About 97, 98.
I received life without possibility of parole for 50 years.
A new documentary looks at the cases of victims of domestic abuse who killed their husbands in an attempt to escape years of torture inflicted upon them. They all received extremely severe sentences. In three of the cases, the women weren't even allowed to enter their abuse into evidence during the trial. So the juries decided their fate without understanding the most pivotal information. The Perfect Victim follows along as a group of lawyers and law students from the Missouri Battered Women's Clemency Coalition work to secure the freedom of these women, who've already missed out on decades of their lives. I spoke with Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, the director of The Perfect Victim, and Amy Lorenz Moser, a lawyer with the Missouri Battered Women's Clemency Coalition, whose work was central in helping to get two of the women featured in the film released.
I wonder first if you can both tell me how you came to be involved in this issue in particular. Elizabeth, why don't you start?
Well, I was a director at MTV, and some friends introduced me to an attorney named Jane Aiken, who was one of the founders of the Missouri Battered Women's Clemency Coalition. So some friends from MTV came on the project as producers, and we drove down to Georgetown, where Jane was a professor, and we did an interview with her, which was very enlightening. And then she gave me some home videos that the students from the Clemency Coalition had taken of these women when they initially put their clemency petitions together. So I watched the videos, and the information in them was just absolutely horrifying. So I knew what I wanted to make a film about. And I found people who had started as law students and had grown into very successful lawyers who were still fighting for the same inmates over a decade of time. And they really all stuck together to fight for the freedom of these women.
And yourself, Amy?
Well, I guess I became interested in domestic violence when I was in college. I was actually sitting in the university center and just watched a guy come in and completely beat his girlfriend who's working behind the counter in the cafeteria. And it was about the most horrible thing I've ever seen. And then later, when I was in law school, I wanted to be in the family violence clinic, and my professor approached me about this particular project, Missouri Battered Women's Clemency Coalition, and asked if I would be interested in representing one of the women. And I was really excited to do it. The lady I represented was a wonderful person. We were lucky enough to be able to get her released from prison. So 16 or so years later, I'm still doing it.
What's the history of the law in Missouri with regard to women who kill their batterers?
Well, in terms of history, there was a time in Missouri law where battered spouse syndrome or battered spouse self-defense wasn't recognized. And so evidence of abuse wasn't very often admitted at trials because it wasn't a defense at all. The defendant didn't ever want to talk about it because it gave motive to the prosecution for the killing. It wasn't a defense unless the killing happened in the heat of battle. In the late 80s, the law changed. A statute was passed that gave women kind of a vehicle to get some of that evidence and through battered spouse syndrome. And what that takes into consideration is the fact that a pattern of abuse can provide some evidence of imminent harm and immediate threat. And it's helpful. Unfortunately, the way that that has played out in cases in our state is that you can't make a case of battered spouse syndrome unless you can also show traditional self-defense. And if you can prove traditional self-defense, you don't need battered spouse syndrome in the first place. It's just something else you have to prove. So it's become a very unfortunate anomaly of the law where it's a defense that isn't really very helpful anymore.
And is this an issue in other states as well as Missouri? You focused on Missouri in the film in these cases.
Well, certainly the trend of the evidence not being admissible and then later battered spouse syndrome statutes were passed all throughout the country in the late 80s and early 90s, where this started to be a more recognized defense. What's required under the statutes, how they have played out in the different states, is very different. Some states recognize the effects of battering, states like California. Other states haven't done a very good job with it, and so you have this defense that isn't used very often because it's very difficult.
Do either of you have any idea how many women are in prison in the U.S. facing sentences of this nature?
There aren't any national statistics that I'm aware of women in prison who could have used battered spouse syndrome that didn't get to.
I have heard through different sources that there are a great number of women who are in prison due to some sort of crime that's connected to violence from a partner in some way. She was carrying drugs for him because she was afraid of him, or you know, all of those various outcomes. But again, I can't speak to exact statistics.
The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence took a look at people in prison for killing their intimate partners. Uh-huh. And they found that the average sentence for a woman who killed an intimate partner was 15 to 20 years, but for a man it was 2 to 6 years.
Wow.
So there's a huge disparity in sentencing. One of the women I represent is a woman named Donna Bernacki. She is serving a 20-year sentence for killing her abusive husband. She has a lot of physical problems. She has MS. At the time that she shot him, she was walking with a cane. The day that she shot him, he was crazy on coke and methamphetamine and threatening her and threatening their children, and she shot him with the gun that was in the house. She was allowed to present evidence of abuse, but they excluded all of the police reports and orders of protection and documents that would have shown the abuse. And then the jury didn't know they could use all that evidence of abuse to try to acquit her. So we're asking for clemency for her. The other woman I represent is a woman named Marty Greer. She's been in prison for 25 years for killing her abusive boyfriend when she was 20 years old. On the day that she shot him in self-defense, he had beaten her unconscious in front of multiple witnesses. She had tried to leave on numerous occasions. She was not with him at the time that he attacked her, and she felt that she needed to defend herself. She took a plea deal to life with the possibility of parole. She doesn't have any previous offenses, and for some reason our Missouri Parole Board won't let her out.
Elizabeth, I wonder what struck you about some of these cases, you know, the dynamics of those situations.
Before I became involved in this project, I really didn't have much of a background on this issue. So I learned from, you know, the ground level up what all of the complexities are when you're dealing with someone who's been with an abusive partner. I would say, first and foremost, I learned that what's in the newspapers and how people talk about things are just not as they seem. And I looked, you know, when we were doing research on this, I looked at newspaper articles that came out when these killings occurred, and the facts that were not included or the misrepresented facts were really astonishing. And I learned that people who believe these women to be liars are simply wrong, because they have not had the chance to listen to them talk about their experiences. And when you have that chance to listen to a victim of abuse go into such horrific detail of some of the abuse that they've endured, both to themselves and to their children, and having to witness that abuse done to their children, your perspective just changes so immediately. And I just don't believe that people can lie that well. And I learned that in watching these videos and in talking to these women, this abuse was just very vivid and very real. And it's not something I believe you can make up. And I also think that I learned that in many ways, what you think would happen if someone was beating you up, what my perception would be, how I would react, or how the law enforcement would react around me, are my perspective on that changed a lot as well, because I think that you figure if you're killing someone in self-defense, there should be no problem, or that's what I, you know, naively thought at the beginning of this process, and I learned that that's not true.
Amy, in the film, there was a couple of women who were released from prison, thanks to your work, but some of them are still behind bars. What is it that's preventing these women from being released?
Well, there's a lot of laws that deal with when people go to jail. There aren't a lot of laws that deal with how are all the creative ways to get people out that don't belong there. So it's really jazz at that point. You're like trying to get special statutes passed. You're doing all kinds of things with the governor's office. You're trying to get people to make an exception to what the law is, because most of the time the law is that they should stay in jail. You've got to get a special exception for them not to be in jail. So that part is a challenge. Another challenge that you always have in cases is when you're working with people that are incarcerated, is it's hard to have access to your client in the way you would have access to a client that was on the outside. So it's, you know, there are some barriers to getting the things you want, to doing the things you want with your client. You know, another access to a lot of other lawyers being involved in this work is that these people don't have any money. So they're stuck with me. They don't have the legal dream team that they might be able to hire if they had a lot of money. And I'm not disparaging myself at all, but, you know, I'm volunteering to do this work for free. There are some other good people volunteering to do that, too. But there isn't a established market for lawyers to do this work, because once you've been in prison for 25 years, anything you have is long gone if you had anything in the first place. So, you know, that's always a barrier.
You just heard an interview with Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, director of the film The Perfect Victim, and Amy Lorenz Moser, a litigator who works with the Missouri Battered Women's Clemency Coalition. The Perfect Victim premiered on April 14th on World Channel, where Americans can watch the film for free from April 15th to October 15th, and is also available on Amazon Prime. Canadians can rent or buy the film on iTunes. To learn more about the film and how you can take action to help, visit theperfectvictim.com.
Today's Wings program comes from two episodes of Megan Murphy's podcast series, Feminist Current. You can find all her podcasts at feministcurrent.com or rabble.ca. Please thank your local community radio station for carrying Wings programs. To hear an episode again, email wings@wings.org. or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Special thanks to our sustaining stations and our personal supporters, including Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.